Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
My name is Julie Douglas.
And we have a guest for today's episode, as you probably gathered from the title. We are talking once again with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
That's right, via the phone.
Yes.
We have a bunch of questions that we lobbed at him, mainly having to do with his wonderful book, which is called Space Chronicles. And it really is a retrospective of NASA and space exploration. And it is so fascinating. It has every single aspect of space that you would ever want to cram into your brain, including like killer asteroids and whether or not aliens might exist. So we had a chance to read that and then to ask some questions. And we also had a chance to give Dr. Tyson some of your questions.
Yes.
That you provided on Facebook.
Yeah, you might remember about a month back, maybe a little longer, when we first learned that we were going to do this interview, I put the call out on Facebook. Our Facebook address, by the way, it's Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Just type that in, do Facebook, and you'll find us. Put the call out for questions that you guys had for Dr. Tyson, and we received a whole list of them. And so we went in and we picked like the five best, and then ask as many of those as we could during the time that we had him. And really, I think some of the answers to your questions were the best, as you'll discover in this episode.
Yeah, I think you guys excited his imagination, so.
But first of all, I do need to mention again, this is a great book. Neil deGrasse Tyson, for those of you who are not familiar with him, you have no excuse not to be familiar with Neil deGrasse Tyson, because
he's everywhere.
He is a mass communicator. He is out there as a spokesman for science, for our understanding of the cosmos, for our continued exploration of the cosmos, and for just science literacy in our culture. And this book is just another great example of that. It's very readable. It is not a heavy, hard to read science book. It is a very readable text it even has his tweets in there, which I thought was a nice
yeah.
a nice touch, because he's a big time tweeter. Big time Twitter user, if you would rather. And you can find him on Twitter at Neil Tyson. That's N-E-I-L-T-Y-S-O-N. Follow him there. He's always throwing out some neat little tidbits about the scientific world, or he's questioning the science of a major motion picture. He's always a lot of fun.
That's right. And, I think I had mentioned it, but he really does lay out some of the mysteries of the universe in a very elegant way, and of course with his signature humor.
Yes.
Which is pretty awesome.
All right. Well, that being said, let's break into the interview itself.
Well, first of all, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
Well, thank you.
On our podcast, we're all about trying to communicate science and mind-blowing topics with our listeners, and so you are, of course, one of our heroes, so it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. Now I have to live up to that.
Well, we thought we'd just go ahead and start talking a little bit about Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. The collection of essays that you have, and really addressing, I think, from soup to nuts, space exploration. I wanted to talk about the political partisanship that you talk about in the book, and I wanted to sort of ask you if you thought that showing the sausage-making part of that would kind of help the public to better understand some of the challenges that face NASA in terms of budget constraints.
Well, almost everything is partisan today, and except for maybe veterans' benefits, you know, some things that are sort of sacred in the budget. And I think the more people see the sausage-making, the more they might become disgusted with the fact that there's sausage-making at all for things that are fundamentally bipartisan, or better yet, fundamentally nonpartisan. So to expose it, I think, is a good thing. Not that I had any secret access to what's going on in Washington, but I offered an analysis of how progress on NASA's budget and progress in space had been had fallen victim to partisan grandstanding. And, you know, space historically has never been partisan at all. In other words, if you liked space or you didn't like space, it was uncorrelated with whether you were left or right or Democrat or Republican or anything. It was just simply because you had an opinion. And that's a good thing about topics, I think. And it means you don't sort of ascribe to how other people want you to think about something. You can come up with your own views. And NASA, in a way, has transcended that. And I think has been one of its strong points. And in fact, most people, particularly in the past 40 years or so, most people who think of America and listed things about America that they liked, most people, that is, around the world, NASA would be like number one on that list. Number one, right? It's not the presidents, and it's not the FBI or the CIA or the military or anything. It's NASA. So what a point of diplomacy that represents when you think about it in a geopolitical way. So I think it's high time that people just sat down and recognize the value of projects that allow you to dream, empower you to dream about tomorrow, the value that those projects have on our ambitions, on our culture, on our educational pipeline, and the urge to get people interested in the STEM field, you know, the science, technology, engineering, and math.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Tyson, in your book you point out that half a penny on the tax dollar is the total cost of all spaceborne telescopes, planetary probes, the rover on Mars, the International Space Station, the Space Shuttle, and telescopes in orbit. You also point out that space exploration has yielded myriad indirect benefits, everything from cordless tools, invisible braces, and long-distance telecommunications to water filters. So, if you had your druthers, how much more would you allocate to NASA on the tax dollar, and what might that yield in terms of direct and indirect returns?
Yeah, so that's an important and excellent question, but I want to unpack it into sort of multiple variables that are contained within it. So, for example, we could list spinoffs from NASA, direct spinoffs, and I give a list in the book, although I don't dwell on that list. I just offer the list, and then I keep going. Because if you went to the list of direct spinoffs, which would include tempered foam and cordless power tools, high-torque battery-operated tools that all came from pioneering efforts to enable space-walking astronauts to repair things while they're in space. You can't just look for the nearest 110-volt plug to plug in your tools. And, you know, things like the inexpensive and accurate LASIK surgery. The list is long, and it's impressive, right on back to the original urge to miniaturize electronics in the first place. So that was not an interest of industry or the public. It was an interest of NASA to reduce the weight of anything you'd be launching from Earth's surface to orbit or anywhere else. And if you ask your grandparents, you know, what their radio looked like, they'll say it was a piece of furniture in their living room. And at that time, no one is thinking, gee, I want to carry that on my hip pocket. it's just not a thought. It didn't even occur to anybody that that's what you might do with a radio one day. So, yes, there's all of these spinoffs, no doubt about it. But if you look at the value of those spinoffs compared with, in other words, the net sales, let's say, of all those spinoffs and compare it to NASA's annual budget, it doesn't compare. It's smaller than NASA's annual budget. So you can't justify NASA's budget based on the economic value of spinoffs. It just doesn't work. So the only time I ever talk about it is when someone else brings it up. And it's only in the book because I have some obligation just to show all the force that NASA represents. The real impact of NASA has to do with its influence on a culture and the urge to embrace innovations in science and technology, because the discoveries of science and technology are writ large daily in the papers when that's the activity you're engaged in. And you ask anyone who has wanted to become a scientist or an engineer, just ask them. Occasionally, it's the great science or engineering teacher in school. It's the, you know, K through 12 would be because you had a great science teacher. That's not the majority. The majority of the cases is a kid saw something in life. They were exposed to some grand vision statement that something bigger than themselves was undertaking. Right? It wasn't just some science class. It wasn't just some science kit whose experiments they performed at home or in school. It was bigger than that. Essentially, 100% of my generation who entered science because they saw that we were going to the moon. That's how old I am, by the way. So they would not cite a science teacher. They'll cite a science teacher for helping them get along or making them appreciate it all the more, but you can't undervalue how much of a force of nature NASA is on the hearts and minds and the dreams of a culture. And to excel at NASA, you have to innovate. And when you do that in a big way, the country becomes an innovation nation. And that's the real return. So the return is you want to assure your economic survival in the future because you are stimulating people to innovate. And innovations in science and technology in the 21st century are the engines of tomorrow's economy. Well, there you have it. There it is. You don't have to beat people over the head to try to make them interested in this stuff. You get that for free. You don't have to worry about keeping your factories here because we'll be making things that no one knows how to make yet because we'll be innovating. You don't have to worry about keeping kids interested in science because the headlines will do that. And everybody looks at these challenges of America falling behind as this series of band-aids that they need to apply and then everything is somehow fixed without looking at the root cause of all the lost vision statements that the citizenry has evaporated from our culture over the past 10 and 20 years.
In your book, you speak about the three factors capable of stirring human cultures to engage in mega projects. Talk about war, economics, and less common these days, obedience to a god or some royal figure. So does it really boil down to negative motivations for culture as a whole? Does it have to be fear or greed, you think, to really get the mega projects such as space exploration out there?
It depends on how you use the word negative, because that would value judge it. And I try not to value judge things. I just put it out there, and I leave the value judging to others. I would say that the greatest driver of human expenditure of capital, be it financial capital or human capital, is war. Now, you can interpret that as defense, all right? And that's the Great Wall of China, for example. That clearly was not a military project for offense. It was a defensive military project, and that was constructed in the interest of the safety and security of its citizens. So you can think of it as negative because it's in response to a threat, right? And then you have economic return. That's only negative if it's sort of badly exploiting people, but in its purest form, economic growth is a good thing for the world. those nations that are wealthier, they live longer and happier lives and with less disease. So economic wealth, though, while not as powerful a driver as war, comes in a very close second. And you just look at, you know, there's Queen Isabella. She didn't say to Columbus, oh, go to the New World and come back and tell us about the botanical explorations you did and show us the maps and we can put it up in our library. No, it was, here's some flags. Wherever you go, put the flag, put the Spanish flag down and, you know, declare these lands for the Spanish Empire. And by the way, try to exploit as much as you can the natural resources so that we can have trade partners or we can become wealthier. And so, yes, there's a sort of a hegemonistic motive there, but at the end of the day, you know, Spain got wealthy because they valued exploration as an economic activity. Columbus, I never met the guy, but surely he did this because he, in his heart, was an explorer. And so the explorer explores, but somebody's got to write the check. And the history of this activity has demonstrated that the check writers are governments when you're exploring where no one has gone before. And private enterprise comes in later and exploits those activities in the financial interest of the nations. Yeah, so in America, a financial incentive to go into space, not because you're going to reap the benefits of spinoffs, but because an innovation nation competes economically in the 21st century. If exploration is not a good enough reason for you to do it, then do it because you don't want to die poor, or you don't want to see a future of America where we are economically weak or powerless on the world stage.
I'm reminded that in 2011, economist Paul Krugman speculated that the discovery of an impending alien attack would fix all of America's economic woes in about 18 months. So if Paul Krugman were to approach you about faking such a threat, what would you say?
No, I would say that there's no doubt of America's resolve when we feel threatened. I think that there's just no question about it. And because a threat transcends politics. If everyone feels threatened, then you're not going to have one person say, well, we're not threatened, if everybody feels threatened. And you have all pistons running aligned in Congress, and the budgets get passed, and military investments flow like rivers. This is a major thesis of the book, based on my read of the history of human conduct. All I would say is the value of these investments not only would return in your security because you want to deflect the asteroid rather than go extinct, but also you become the kind of economy that thrives on innovation. And that's my only point. It becomes an investment at that point. Mm-hmm. And the very question, oh, can we really afford it? Of course you can afford it because you invest it. You're investing. And you're expecting a return on that investment in the form of a wealthier nation in the decades to come. And by the way, that transcends timescales of quarterly reports and annual reports and congressional reelection times. So somebody needs the foresight necessary to put this into motion to assure a future stability of our nation's economy.
You know, you're talking about taking the long view, and I can't help but think about the long view in asteroids, near-Earth objects.
Oh, you can, huh?
No, you can't help. It's not even really the long view.
For decades, this has been, you know, any astrophysicist in arm's reach could have told you all about the asteroid threat. And mm-hmm. apparently, we are, as a culture, as a world, we are feeble-minded such that we don't believe it until it happens. And then it's kind of too late. You know, it's a little, you know, excuse me. Somehow a threat isn't real unless it's staring you in the face. The good thing about science is that you can predict the coming of a threat, yet that's apparently not enough to trigger people's actions. The good thing, the silver lining of the Urals meteor in Russia, is that nobody died. Mm-hmm. Many people injured, but nobody died. And so therefore, if we had to be slammed by something and learn a lesson from it, it was an ideal sort of lesson because everybody just needed to get a little patched up and go on about their way, fix a few walls and windows. What a lesson that is. What a shot across the bow that was. But again, if we were already into space, this would be a trivial extension of activities we were already engaged in. If all you're going to say now is let's go into space so that we can stop an asteroid, you're missing the point.
Mm-hmm.
You're missing the point. That's like saying, I try to analogize it to the building of the interstate system in the country. If someone said, let's build an interstate to connect New York and Los Angeles, well, that's useful for sure, but how about all the rest of the country? Well, how about that? How about the other cities? What are you only going to do it to bring people from one place to another because that's all you can think of doing when there's all the rest of the country that is waiting to be explored? So I view the entire solar system as our backyard. And when you do, you know, maybe there's an asteroid miners one day and we show them our latest telescope data and they say there's an asteroid headed our way. Could you guys snare it before it puts us at risk? And they'll go ahead and snare it because they know how to manipulate and maneuver and mine asteroids. The government would pay for that, but they wouldn't have to, like, launch it themselves.
All right, we're just going to take one quick break, and when we come back, more questions with Neil deGrasse Tyson, including your questions. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, we're back. Let's jump right back into the interview with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
You have a very elegant explanation of asteroids and long-period comets in your book, in Space Chronicles, and I thought it just really laid out the reasons why we can detect some and the reasons why we can't detect others. In particular, you talk about Apophis, which I know you've talked about before in the media, and how this is actually something that's very serious that we need to focus on. And I thought that maybe you could talk a little bit about that in practical terms, how we confront a problem like this, an asteroid that's in our view. And then a second part to that, I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the role of privatization of asteroid mining and how that may or may not affect asteroids.
Yeah, you know, if you're macho, you might say, let's blow the sucker out of the sky. You know, you got nukes in the silos left over from the Cold War, put them to good use. And, you know, what I say often, and as all that I know of the American Armed Forces tells me this is true, that we're really good at blowing stuff up and less good at knowing where the pieces will fall. And that seems to have applied literally and metaphorically to our military policy. If your objective to be to blow up an asteroid, I'd be concerned that the one spot that was originally targeted by this asteroid is now headed to two places instead of one. So what have you done? Now you have to evacuate both coasts. There's some emerging consensus among those who have studied the problem, myself included, that the soundest way to approach this problem is through an asteroid deflection scenario. The asteroid will continue to live another day and possibly harm you in another day, but the advantage of it is you get to nudge it slowly, and you get to watch how effective you've been, and you keep doing it until you are as effective as you need it to be.
And so with Apophis, the idea of this is that when it comes very close to the Earth in 2029, that you alter its course a bit so that in its return orbit, it doesn't slam into the Earth. Is that
precisely? Because the later you get to the problem, the more the all your capacity to solve that problem drops.
Gotcha. And a lot of this is looking into the crystal ball, but, you know, there's been talk about asteroid mining and private companies taking that on because, you know, at some point it might yield some profits, certainly not right away. The question, I think, for us is, if you have so much space junk, if you have near-Earth objects in orbit, and you have private companies up there now with their equipment, do they then have an obligation to help clean up space junk, to help deflect near-Earth objects?
I wouldn't call it an obligation. I would just call it know-how. You know, who do you get? I mean, forgive me for referencing the movie Armageddon, but they had a task set out in front of them in the film to bury a nuke in an asteroid because otherwise it won't blow it apart. So in the ranks of NASA, there was no one who had any experience drilling into solid rock or something hard to penetrate. And so they got Bruce Willis and his crack team of, I guess they're oil rig drillers or something. And so they had a very specific talent set, unique to the task. So if we are busy turning the solar system into our backyard, then there will be a mining company exploiting asteroids. So we would presume that if asteroid mining was an activity, an economic activity, then they would know how to get to asteroids, how to mine them, how to turn them around, how to tow them from one location to another to be better suited for their access. And if you have that capability, then why wouldn't they be the ones you would task to deflect an asteroid. And it becomes their asteroid, right? Oh, there's one coming our way. Why don't you just take it and mine it for all it's worth, and we're done with it. But that'd be kind of cool if every asteroid that would end life on Earth simply became a source of natural resources to help life on Earth. That's the kind of thinking that goes on when you're in an innovation nation. A storm is ready to hit the coast. You know, do you run away from it and buy up all the water from the shelves, or do you say, how can I mitigate that storm? Or how can I deflect that storm? How can I tap the cyclonic energy contained within it and drive the energy needs of the city that it's about to destroy? So I wouldn't call it an obligation. I would just call it, yeah, of course they'll do it. I mean, of course. And they'll know how to. Other people will have money but not the know-how, so you pay them. I mean, it's a company, and they use their resources. You pay them to use their resources. You know, the post office doesn't fly their own airplanes. They pay commercial carriers to fly mail, U.S. mail, in their belly. The government has had this kind of relationship with a business forever. You know, how do we make the Jeep in World War II? The government gave money to Chrysler. Said Chrysler had a good design. They built the Jeep. And they still make Jeeps. And they make money off of it. That's how we're in a capitalist society. That's how, you know, that's how that's supposed to work.
Obviously, the wave of public and political support for space exploration has ebbed and flowed over the years. But what if we had somehow maintained it at its 1969 level? How far would we be today?
Oh, so at the level you're talking about would be the 1966 level.
Okay.
That's where NASA's funding had peaked.
Okay.
It peaked as a percentage of the federal budget. It peaked at about 4%. In fact, there's a huge set of appendices in Space Chronicles where I plot the NASA's budget over 50 years, and in there is the original founding document of NASA. NASA was founded like the same week I was born, so I feel NASA's pains and joys and challenges. So in there you can see the plot of its of the budget. It's a stunning difference between the commitment that we made as a nation over that period and the commitment we're making now. Now, you don't have to always keep the commitment that high. If the nation gets wealthier, which it has done over the decades, then your percentage could go down, yet your net money could go up. I mean, that's how that works, if you're always referencing your budget as a percent of the federal budget. But to put some numbers on this, it was 4% in 1966, going into 1967. That was sort of the peak buildup of the Apollo program. And if we had that money now, NASA's budget would be eight times, a factor of eight, larger than its current value. If NASA were appreciated at the same percent of the federal budget that it was back then. And I would claim that at a much lower price tag than that, you can turn the entire solar system into your backyard. You can reach a space frontier. And these are stories that the press would write about.
I wanted to ask if you thought that an Earth-like planet might be discovered, I don't know, in 50 years, 100 years, and do you think that it's something like citizen science that'll be a part of it in the absence of a Sputnik moment or an alien attack?
The Sputnik moments and the alien attacks are the kind of forces that galvanize an entire society. But in any society, there are always people, in any wealthy society, there are always people who will spend their mental and emotional energies thinking about discovery. It's been going on, people have been doing that ever since the beginning. You know, who's the first one to leave the cave? That's somebody who wants to discover. It's an urge within us that I don't think we should stand in denial of, although many people have forgotten what it is or what it felt like to explore. Every child knows what it's like to explore. They turn over rocks and climb trees and pluck, if they're suburban, you climb trees. They pluck petals off roses, jump 2 feet in puddles. They, you know, this is what kids do. They catch snowflakes in their mouths. And adults somehow lose this playful curiosity about the world around them. And all you need to do is keep it. You don't have to create it from scratch. It was already there. Just find ways to foster it and nurture it, and then you're coming along nicely. So Now, the thrust of your question was?
I just wondered if you thought that an Earth-like planet might be discovered in the next 50 years, and do you think that citizen science will be a part of that, since we're somewhat hamstrung in terms of budgets to really look very hard for an Earth-like planet?
Sure. Well, we already have Earth-like planets in the catalog. So the challenge is an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone, the Goldilocks zone, of its host star. Not too close, otherwise if it had liquid water, it would evaporate. And not too far, because if it had liquid water, it would freeze. And that's not useful to life as we know it, which requires liquid water. So we have planets that have been discovered. There's just not many of them. There's by a handful, fewer than five out of the, we're rising through 1,000 exoplanets that are in the catalogs today. Citizen science is a wonderful exploitation of the internet, and we should have more of it, especially since in the astrophysics community, we are overrun with data, with the scales of data that we simply can't analyze ourselves. And I think that's a good thing. I think there should be more of it, especially for the data-heavy fields such as my own. But that itself is not going to transform a culture. That's a side activity for people who already know they like science.
Okay, how are you doing on time? Do you have time for a few of the listener-submitted questions, or do you need...
Yeah, sure. I got about 15 more minutes. We're good.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go through these. If you don't like the question, or you...
I'll take any question you give me.
Okay, all right. Well, this first question comes from a listener named Mike. Mike asks, can you expound in a simple way on how dark matter and energy seem to bind and expand the matter we see as the visible universe?
So if you think of mass... All right. Mass can be manifested in two ways. In one form, it is energy. In another form, it's matter. Okay? Think of it that way. And each of those contain mass, or a mass equivalent. And our understanding of the universe, its beginning, its evolution, its end, sort of flows through that understanding. And you can look at how much mass there is in the universe and what it's doing to the universe. Over the years, beginning in 1936, we learn that there's more going on in the universe than just what our mass is doing. So in 1937, we discovered there's gravity out there that has no known point of origin. And then in two decades ago, in the late 90s, that is, we found that there's a pressure in the vacuum of space that's forcing the universe to expand. So, and those are huge fractions of all that is driving the universe. If you add up the extra gravity, which we call dark matter, with the extra pressure in the vacuum of space, which we call dark energy, it's 96% of everything we know. 96%. So, you could say we're just completely stupid about how the universe works, although the part we do know works really, really well. So that's a good thing. But the rest, if you combine them, so there's our sort of mass, which is matter and energy, and then the dark matter and the dark energy, all of this is what's driving the universe. And the total sort of energy content of the universe is contained in the sum of those three. And we don't know what's causing the dark matter, and we don't know what's causing the dark energy.
Okay. Our next question comes to us from listener Jerry. Jerry asks, how do we communicate science effectively, and what other science communicators do you admire other than the great Sagans or Attenboroughs?
So in America, we do a few things very well, or at least we do a few things famously. One of them is we make jets. All right. Another one is our entertainment industry. America entertains the world with our movies, our TV shows, our podcasts. Our broadcast content is an extraordinary gift to the world. Any of us remember when you visit other countries when you were a kid, you put on the TV and there's your favorite TV show dubbed in the local language. Whereas we don't have any of their TV shows dubbed in English, right? So there's clearly a one-way street going on here where we're entertaining the world. It would be irresponsible of anyone who is trying to teach an electorate, it would be irresponsible if they didn't exploit the power of media, entertainment media, in delivering the messages. So that's just an important fact.
Okay, we have another question that comes to us from listener Cody. Cody asks, what's your view on the connection between science and philosophy?
There's a very long tradition of a marriage between science and philosophy that goes back forever. And well, if you look at what the philosopher sort of assesses the landscape and then sits in a chair and thinks about it, deep thoughts, and then comes up with some new understanding, with some new outlook on that landscape. Philosophers at their best, that's what they do. The scientists at their best will assess the landscape, propose an idea for how or why that landscape should be something else, or something different, or something more nuanced, and then they'll devise an experiment to test the idea. If the idea is not supported by experiment, they discard the idea and then move on to a next one. So the difference between the philosopher and the scientist is that the philosopher has no laboratory. The philosopher has no telescope. The philosopher has no particle accelerator. And when physics, which I'm using sort of as a lead science in my answer to your question, when physics left the tabletop, which was basically 120 years ago, it left the tabletop and entered the realm of the quantum, which lives wholly outside of human experience and human common sense, and it looked at the large-scale structure of the universe. These two extremes fall so far away from your life experience that you can't sit on a couch and deduce the nature of the world from your own life experience, because your life experience doesn't contain that which the experiments are demonstrating, that how the actual world behaves. Now, of course, Einstein conjured up relativity, you know, not quite out of the blue, but there were some puzzling things that could not be understood. And he wrote a mathematical formalism for his theory, and then that came up with predictions. So then we tested the predictions, and his theories turned out to be true. So that's a good thing. Philosophers don't tend to bring math to the problem in the way actual scientists do. They're more sort of idea-driven than calculation-driven. Historically, that's how that's been the case. So could a philosopher have come up with relativity? I suppose, but they didn't. A philosopher surely could have come up with evolution, because the data were available, although Darwin had some extra data to really drive it home. But that one didn't require fancy equipment to have resolved. A biology philosopher, in principle, could have come up with evolution by natural selection, but they didn't. It was a scientist. And so you look at progress in our understanding of the natural world in the last 100 years, in the last 150 years, that progress has primarily been by the thinking of scientists, not of philosophers. Now, you can say some scientists are thinking philosophically. I don't have a problem with that. But to say, let us train people in philosophy so that they can become better scientists, I don't approve of that at all. That my read of how that has gone in the past century tells me that you are removing yourself from the frontier of cosmic discovery. Now, there are some branches of science that are brand new, like spanking brand new, like neuroscience, all right? That's only been on the map, you know, 10 years, tops. Before then, there are people, you know, poking around the brain, but it hadn't really taken off as its own field, where you can get degrees in it. And that's early enough that, and plus the mind is so fascinating and so complex, and there's so many ways that you can think about how it works and how it doesn't work. It might benefit from the efforts of philosophers, and I know there are a bunch of sort of neurophilosophers who are orbiting the field in an effort to contribute. And my hope is that they can and set things in directions that they need to be, in the way early philosophers with regard to physics did for physicists. There are other branches of, you know, this philosophy of ethics, this religious philosophy. There are other kinds of philosophy out there. You were specifically, I presume, referring to philosophers in ways that they might contribute to the advancing frontier of science. And there are questions that philosophers ask that are just simply not useful to a scientist. Like, how do you really know the moon is there? You say, well, I have light, and that's just the light of the moon. You know, how about the moon itself? Well, I could measure. Well, that's just a measurement of the light of the moon. And you could down many pints of beer discussing those things. There's a chunk of philosophers who are asking the question, is the molecule H2O water? If you isolate a single H2O molecule, is that water? Or is water the macroscopic properties we give when you have countless numbers of these, and then it flows and it's liquidy, and, you know, it's not a liquid, it's not a solid, it's not anything, it's just a molecule. There are philosophers arguing this, publishing papers on this. And the scientist just doesn't have time, the luxury of time, I call them beer conversations. Conversations where you just sort of, you question the existential conversations about knowledge and life and mind and matter, you know, okay, but it's not useful in the laboratory.
Let me just follow up on that too. I was thinking about ethics in terms of philosophy, and many times it comes up. So you're talking about, for instance, bringing back the woolly mammoth, or if you're talking about artificial intelligence and you're talking about ethics there, making certain that some sort of piece of technology isn't going to show up on the black market. How much of that should a science be concerned with before or after the creation, the possibility?
So I'm curious whether there is a negative argument to cloning a mammoth other than, no, it's extinct, so leave it extinct. You know, I mean, I don't. Someone's going to clone a mammoth. You know, you get the tissue out of the glacier as the glacier melts, because all our glaciers are melting, so all kinds of fun ice age creatures are going to be spilling out of that glacier, probably a few cavemen while we're at it. And so, if we have the power to clone it, somebody's going to clone it. Now, to ask what the ethics of that is, I think there are more interesting ethical questions that are in front of us than whether we clone a mammoth, like, you know, cloning people or cloning or creating deadly viruses, you know, that could be used genocidally. I mean, so if you were to rank the topics top to bottom, what we do with the mammoth, I don't think people are going to protest.
I agree. I think that what I'm thinking about is how much should the scientist concern him or herself when they are going through the motions of what is possible, what can be created? Is this out of the realm of scientists? Should they concentrate on what is possible? And, you know, does society create the ethics? Should there be any sort of overlapping there? Is that a job of the scientist to think about ethics?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I think it's the job of the scientist as a citizen to think about it. You know, all citizens should be thinking about sort of the ethical conduct of the species. And fortunately, there's been some good investment in this along these lines over the decades and over the centuries, so that there's actually been ethical shifts in our conduct over the years, right? You know, there are books written on how to treat your slave ethically, and they don't address the question of why you would have a slave in the first place, right? So fortunately, there's a collective sense of what is good and what is right that is not anchored in some time past where the needs and the conduct of what was considered reprehensible behavior of the past, defended by whatever documents people had or whatever their upbringing was, that does not carry into the future. I'm glad for that, right? I am free because of that. So that's fine. So I think the ethics can be an evolving conversation. I'm old enough to remember all this conversation about in vitro fertilization, you know, the first test tube baby. Should we? Is it, you know, now it doesn't even make a news story if someone's born from a test tube. It's a non-story. And so, but at the time, people said, what's the ethics of this? And it's like, you know, chill out, you know, just try to think it through and, you know, look at the benefits and is there a downside? That isn't religion. You know, religion is always telling you what you shouldn't do. And so if your only rebuttal is religion and you haven't really thought it through rationally, then you're missing some further conversations that should be had about what goes on. There's something else is true, that needs to be on the table, that science fiction writers are awesome at depicting futures where science goes bad. And they create terrifying images of nuclear energy gone bad, you know, cloning gone bad, viruses gone bad. And I'm happy to report that there has never been science gone bad by the efforts of a mad scientist who wants to take over the world. What we really have to watch out for are mad politicians, right? Even the atom bomb, yes, that was a whole set of complicit physicists who made that bomb. There's no doubt about it, but somebody paid their way. Somebody wrote their paycheck. Somebody funded that entire enterprise, and those are governments. Those are Congress. That is an electorate. That is a president. That is a president's cabinet. Somebody else, by geopolitical forces, are deciding what they want to do with the science. And you will never find scientists leading armies to invade other countries. It's just not what we do. So the ethical conduct is not so much of what a scientist does, but how does a society react to the discoveries of science? And that needs to be and there's some overlap there, of course, between the two. But ethics is a cultural problem, not simply that of what a scientist does. Almost every scientific discovery that we've ever found has extraordinary benefit to humankind. Extraordinary. The early days of nuclear physics, where we found radioactive materials, and Marie Curie died of some kind of cancer, I think it was leukemia, surely as a result of her playing around with radium, named because of its radioactive properties. There's an entire branch of medicine called radiology, which is the benefits of the investments of physicists who are trying to understand nature at its most basic level. So extraordinary benefits to society await us by every scientific discovery that is to come. History tells us.
Okay, well, that concludes the interview. I hope that you guys have enjoyed that. Again, thank you guys for giving us some great questions for him to answer.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
And I think we have time for a bit of mail here.
Let's see. Let's call the robot over. Okay, we heard from listener Adam, and Adam writes in with an email titled Discovering Nutmeg in India, of course, responding to our episode that we did on the science and history of nutmeg. He says, hey guys, I went on a tour of Kerala's backwaters, basically huge waterways that people live alongside, and we went to a spice farm. Guess what was there? Nutmeg. My first thought was your podcast about nutmeg last year. As the guide explained it, he went part by part. The red part inside is called mace in the local language and is extremely expensive. It's used in Indian dishes like biryani. The best part, however, was when he described how you could get a quote-unquote kick from eating too much nutmeg. I don't think the others understood, but thanks to your podcast, I knew exactly what he meant. Thanks again, and keep up the great work. Some pictures from the tour attached with the nutmeg at the bottom. And Adam, of course, is the chief happiness officer who's been traveling around the world and regularly writes into our podcast and a few other How Stuff Works podcasts as well. And you can find out more about what he's up to at happinessplunge.com. But yeah, he sent us a number of these pictures, and as always, it's just fascinating glimpse into his travels.
Yeah, I love that, too, that the tour guide had the little wink-wink, nudge-nudge, because they're referring to the hallucinogenic properties of nutmeg, which we've probably said this a million times by now, not worth it. If anybody is sort of like, wow, that has hallucinatory properties, that is not the stuff that anybody really wants to play with, I should say.
We also heard from a couple of listeners out there who were really taken by our episodes that dealt with the shadow self as it relates to, in one episode, pro wrestling. In the other episode, we talked about undercover cops who have a false identity that they're using, and also actors, in method or otherwise, that have to cloak themselves in some level of fiction in order to do their thing. So we heard from Josephine. Josephine writes in and says, hi, Robert and Julie. I really enjoyed your last episode on the self and the roles we play. I really enjoy your other podcast as well, of course, and had a couple of things to contribute to the discussion. First, I went and listened to Thandi Newton's TED Talk, and at one point she mentions feeling that she didn't have a self since she was able to play other people so well. That reminded me of another actor who supposedly felt the same way, Peter Sellers. On the subject of playing characters, as an actor myself, I find it best to take some methody step to get to the right place emotionally. But I find the strangest thing in my case is that though I always have my home self, whatever character I'm playing at the time usually rubs off on me a bit. It's sort of like who I normally am is being shown through the lens of another personality. I remember one character I played, Charles II of England's minister, Nell Gwyn, who was very happy and positive, had a particular effect on me, and my mum's always said that she can come back anytime she likes. Can't wait to hear your next podcast. Sincerely, Josephine. In Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Huh, very interesting. I can't help but think of personality as sort of like a prism, and it kind of depends on which direction the light is hitting it, in which you exhibit whatever feelings or personality at that time. And we've talked about this before, about how it's related to consciousness and the unconscious. So, again, it's very interesting to me to know that personality isn't something that is always a stable thing. We really have to work at it because it's part of that construction of our reality.
We also heard from a listener by the name of Stephanie. Stephanie writes in and says, hello, Robert and Julie. Greetings from Toronto. Another one. And she's responding to the same episode. So there you go. I wonder if they know each other. She says, I recently enjoyed listening to your episode on undercover actors in the shadow self. You invited undercover agents and actors to write in and share their experiences of identity and role-playing. While I don't fit either of those descriptions, I thought you'd be interested in my perspective on the issue, since I suffer from what might be diagnosed as a particularly acute form of imposter syndrome as a result of the way people respond to my outer self. Yes, it's much different from my inner self. I'm 30 with a PhD and a tenure-track appointment at a major Canadian research university, but I look like I'm about 17, with wide blue eyes and a small stature at 5'2 and about 100 pounds. While the situation is well-situated for winning the biggest stuffed animal prize at the age-guessing carnival booth and convincing a class of undergraduates that you're a child genius, a real-life Doogie Howser, it often just makes me feel claustrophobic in my own body. The way I'm treated by others never seems to match my sense of self. Since starting as faculty at the university this past summer, the situation has become its most intense. Each new person I meet, student, staff, or fellow faculty member, treats me like a first-year student unless I correct them, which for the most part, I've given up doing. After encountering this response multiple times a day from a range of people for the past several months, I'm beginning to feel like a young actor playing a grown-up role. I'm not sure if this is just a serious case of imposter syndrome or whether a more fundamental shift in my sense of self is happening. Your discussion made me wonder what I'd be like, who I'd be, if the way others respond to me had always aligned with my age and general intelligence level. I've attached a picture of me on my honeymoon that illustrates this issue. More evidence available here. And then she sent us a Flickr page. She says, love the podcast, Stephanie.
And I did see that picture. And yes, she does come across as very young. And I have to say that I understand what she's saying, because up to a certain age, I had the same problem. And it is a little bit odd, because people don't expect you to sort of come out as the person that you are. They think that, and not that I'm petite and I look like I'm 18, because certainly neither one of these is true. But people don't always expect, the certain personality to come out.
Yeah, it is. It was a really fascinating email to read, to think about, what happens when who we feel we are inside is out of step with our outer self, be it because of our physical appearance or because of the way we end up carrying ourselves in the world. Or even just how we are in first impressions versus how we really are. I mean, you do get into this complex question of who are we really,
Well, and especially if you look at those studies that say that, in particular, men who are taller tend to have more responsibilities put upon them and tend to get promoted more and so on and so forth. Now, that's a huge generalization, but actually, I should dig up that study so I can talk about it a little bit more in detail. But things like that, that color people's perception and then the way that you get to operate in the world. So if you are that person, or if you're not that person, or if you're blonde or so on and so forth, how does that affect the way that you accept certain responsibilities in the world or don't accept them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm 6'2 or 6'3, depending on, how I want to measure myself, I guess. I guess I'm 6'3, but sometimes I hold it at 6'2 because that feels like a good cutting off point. But,
You were just promoted to, president of the universe.
No, well, I think now I grow my sideburns long, and so that, people might see me and they're like, who's that tall guy? We should promote him to a level of incompetence. And then they see my sideburns and they're like, maybe not.
So. You just cited the Peter Principle.
Did I?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I have been there to varying degrees in the past before I wound up here and grew my sideburns out. So, yeah.
You've been to the Peter Principle?
Well, I have found myself being, when I was in newspapers, I found myself gaining more and more responsibilities that I didn't really want or enjoy or even was necessarily that good at them. But
yeah. No, I think everybody has stepped into Peter's suit at one time or another.
So my advice is grow your sideburns out, everyone. Ladies, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm working on mine.
All right. Well, if you have anything you would like to share with us, be it about this whole conundrum we were just talking about related to self, about the shadow self, and if you have any feedback or anything to add regarding the Neil deGrasse Tyson interview, we'd love to hear from you. Again, it was a tremendous treat to speak with Dr. Tyson, and I really enjoyed getting to share your questions with him. So I really think from now on, whenever it's possible, I will reach out to people on Facebook and let you guys contribute at least some of the questions for our interviews. So if you want to do that, if you want to find us on Facebook and follow us so that you can be on top of that, again, Facebook, we are Stuff to Blow Your Mind. We're also Stuff to Blow Your Mind on Tumblr. And on Twitter, we go by the handle Blow the Mind.
And you can always drop us a line at blowthemind@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.